You're listening to a program created at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Thank you for supporting our research in consciousness and its practical applications for education, healthcare, and a more sustainable world. For more information, visit us at www.noetic.org.
Welcome to the seventh teleseminar in our series Exploring the Noetic Sciences. Tonight's teleseminar explores mind, brain, and consciousness with Fridasi, MD. And now I'll turn things over to our host, IONS Senior Scientist, Dean Radin.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Larry Dossey needs no introduction, but I'll introduce him anyway. Larry is the author of a number of influential books on healing and medicine and non-local mind, including such books as The Extraordinary Healing Power of Ordinary Things, Healing Words, Reinventing Medicine, Recovering the Soul, Prayer is Good Medicine, Healing Beyond the Body, and his most recent book, The Power of Premonitions. So I thought that today we would talk a little bit about premonitions, given that that's Larry's latest book, and then if we have time to talk about a few other mysteries of the mind and consciousness that suggest that the brain and the mind and consciousness may not be identical. In the neurosciences today, it is often assumed that the brain and the mind are exactly the same, and also that the brain gives rise to consciousness. There are a number of bodies of evidence suggesting that maybe that is not completely correct. So one that we can talk about is an editorial that Larry wrote on the memory effects associated with transplants, like transplanted organs. The other possibility is talking about both a recent case and previous cases of people who have had head trauma and then went into coma, and when they woke up from the coma, that they were able to do things like speak a language that they didn't know before. And then the last case we might talk about is called terminal lucidity, which is a unusual thing that happens for people who have been either in coma or in some cases or with severe dementia, and they wake up just before they die and they're completely lucid. And this has been reported in the medical literature about 80 times. And so these cases are again a challenge to the idea that if something is neurologically wrong with the brain, then how can these people suddenly become lucid and very lucid for a matter of minutes to days before they die? So with that as an introduction, welcome, Larry.
Well, Dean, thanks. It's always a pleasure to talk to you at IONS and to interface with your listeners.
Good. So one thing we can start with then is you provided a little description of premonitions as a gateway to noetic science.
I think it is a gateway. I think if there's one thing that draws IONS members together, it's this idea that there is something more than the physical brain. We struggle for words for that. Consciousness and mind do it for me. But the prevalent notion that we've been dragooned with in science for the better part of the 20th century, which you've just elaborated on, which is that this idea that consciousness is nothing more than the brain and the brain gives rise to it, I think is in deep trouble. And the reason it is because it can't account for how consciousness manifests in the world. One of the ways that consciousness manifests in the world that has captivated me over the past few years has to do with the subject of my most recent book, The Power of Premonitions, in which people acquire information before it's even happened. There is no known way, not even any theory, that says how the brain should be able to do that. And so here we bump into this very inconvenient truth, I call it, for modern neuroscience, which is that consciousness can apparently do things that the brain simply can't do. And that's what we're faced with here. And premonitions give us a dramatic example of that.
I agree. Maybe you can give one of your favorite examples from your book to illustrate it.
Yeah, I like this example because it captures so many of the features of premonition, which is the mother-child motif, the importance of compassion and love and connectedness between people. And this example has to do with a young mother in the Pacific Northwest who had a dream one night that a chandelier in the room where her child or infant was sleeping in the crib fell from the ceiling, fell onto the infant, killed the baby, wrecked the crib, and she woke up from this horrible nightmare. She woke her husband up, described it to him, and he was not impressed. He said, "It's just a dream. It's just a nightmare. Go back to sleep," which he promptly did. Well, in the nightmare, she saw a clock on the baby's bureau, which read 4:35 a.m. She and her husband did go back to sleep. She could not, so she gets up and goes into the baby's room, picks the baby up, and brings the baby back to bed with them. A couple of hours later, they're awakened by a terrible noise in the baby's room. They both get up, they go in, and they see that the chandelier has indeed fallen out of the ceiling and wrecked the infant's crib, and the clock does read 4:35. So this woman had a specific precognitive dream down to the very minute, and it was in camera-like detail. Because she assumed that she could make a difference in how the future unfolded, she did save the baby's life by acting on the precognitive dream and taking it seriously. So you see this mother-child motif so frequently in these sorts of things, and you also see what I think is one of the great features of premonitions, which is the survival function that many of these premonitions serve. She certainly acted to help her child survive and make a huge difference in the way she saw the dream unfold. She didn't change it totally. The chandelier did fall, but she certainly changed the outcome as far as the child was concerned.
So how do you interpret what amounts to a causal paradox where she had a premonition of something and then intervened so the something would not occur?
Well, I think there are many ways that one could approach this. I think that this is what I want to call indirect evidence of freedom of will and the ability of intention to change not a fixed future, but a probabilistic future. I think that the nightmare gave her a probable view of the future, which would have occurred had she not chosen to intervene. But I think premonitions show us that although the future can be glimpsed in its probabilistic nature, there's wiggle room. There's room for us to exercise intentions in the present to shift the probabilities that might occur in the future. So I think that's what we're seeing in premonitions of this sort. She didn't change it totally. As I mentioned, the chandelier did crash and wreck the crib, but she certainly shifted the probabilities as far as the survival of her baby was concerned.
Mm-hmm. Another possibility is that the future which is seen is in fact exactly the one that she experienced, but that because our memories, our images, and so on, even our conscious awareness is a construction, that in witnessing something like a crashing of a chandelier on a crib, that you begin to immediately say, "Oh my God, if the baby had been there," and so you spin out a different kind of story, which in a dream state plays out as though the baby actually was there.
Aha, uh-huh. That's so very interesting, Dean.
The reason I say this is because the issue of what precognition and premonition see is not resolved. We don't know whether it's the actual future or the probable future because of this confound in that we don't even know that what we're seeing now is correct.
Indeed, yes. You know, there's another aspect of that that particular premonition that I find fascinating. It's the reluctance of men to accept the premonitions of women as valid. You see this over and over again in premonition accounts. There is a gender difference in the premonition stories and anecdotes that one can gather. Women seem more open to these things, and I'm not sure I know why that's so, but it certainly seems to be.
Well, what's interesting is that even the laboratory studies that have been looking at precognition show that women oftentimes do better. So this is true in the studies that I've done and now in some of the colleagues of mine who are looking at gender differences. Women just do better in these experiments. And we don't know exactly why, but the empirical evidence and it matches the anecdotal evidence. So maybe there's something about differences in brain structure or something like that. You know, the curious thing that we deal with here is that some aspects of the neurosciences are clearly correct. There's a huge amount of evidence suggesting that we process information with the brain. But that doesn't necessarily mean that every aspect of our conscious awareness and our consciousness in general has to be produced by the brain. And it's that difficulty that the neurosciences have yet to struggle with.
Well, struggle with, indeed they do. And what we have seen, those of us who pay attention to the research which you do and I write about, we see that skeptics just sort of skim off the top, as it were, and select the kind of information and the experiments that fit their pet theories and ignore the inconvenient evidence such as we are concerned at in IONS and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you do that, if you pursue that sort of strategy, you can just sort of stack the deck and construct a reality that suits you. But that's not good science, as I think you probably would agree.
Right. Sometimes I think this is a slightly deflection here, but it occurred to me that it can be very annoying when working at the frontiers of science to constantly be challenged by mainstream view, which tends to be much more conservative. And this is true in every discipline, not just the noetic sciences, but every discipline always is struggling against the accepted wisdom. And in thinking about that, I said, well, it must be just part of human nature to remain conservative, to go with what is comfortable. And why would that be? Well, if everybody was a highly creative artist or scientist, maybe society wouldn't work that well. You know, you'd have people wanting to go off and strike new paths all the time rather than making sure that there's enough stability within society as a whole to allow us creative people to go off and do things. Like if I had to work on the farm all day, I wouldn't have time to do any experiments. So there may be a certain degree of a good reason for why there's a strong conservative streak in most people and in society at large.
Well, I think that's certainly true in medicine, which is my profession. One could make a long list of what are considered conventional therapies now, which were considered in their own day as something as radical as noetic sciences are currently. Even the notion of x-rays. X-rays were condemned as an absolute hoax in the latter part of the 1800s. So it is the nature of many sciences to be conservative, and I think you're quite right. Being conservative prevents these wide swings of the pendulum, and God knows that in medicine there are certainly enough zany ideas that have come along to, I think, point to the value of conservatism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the flip side, of course, is that conservatism and high creativity are at odds with each other. So since that doesn't seem to be changing much, then maybe there's a certain value in the tension.
I think you're right.
Yeah, I don't particularly like that tension since I'm sort of in the midst of it, and you certainly are as well. But I, you know, rather than getting annoyed at it all the time, I just look at it as, that's par for this particular game.
Well, I think you're to be admired for your balance in that regard, Dean. I must confess that I get tremendously irritated by what I think is pathological conservatism, which is the deliberate willful ignorance and the ignoring of data that hasn't been produced by just some scientist over on the other side of the world, but in many cases has been replicated by scientists around the world. And it's that sort of willful ignorance that I think drives some of us up the wall from time to time. Certainly,
right.
That's the case for me.
Yeah, it can be annoying at times, but then again, there are good reasons for why your blood pressure should go up, and this one is something that is the least controllable through attitude, so I figure, well, I'm going to let that one slide.
Yeah, you know, that old saw which expresses pathological conservatism, in which the scientist refused to even read a paper which dealt with clairvoyance or telepathy, I forget which, and in his refusal sent a comment to the editor of the journal, which had asked him to peer review this paper. He said, "This is the sort of thing I would not believe even if it were true."
Mm-hmm.
It's when skepticism degenerates to that sort of gutter level that I think science is really poorly served.
I agree. And scientists are human, so I can agree with it, and yet I kind of forgive it at the same time. So one of the other premonitions, the stories that you have in your book, which I think is really striking, is the case of the choir in church. Can you tell that one?
Yeah. I like this because this points to features of premonitions which a lot of people just simply don't think about very frequently. It's their collective nature and their unconscious nature. This had to do with an event that happened in a little town called Beatrice, Nebraska in 1950 a Baptist church, a small Baptist church in that little tiny town in southeastern Nebraska. On Wednesday night, they always had choir practice, and there were 15 choir members who met religiously at around 7:25, and at 7:30, they cranked up choir practice. And on this particular night, however, nobody showed up. This was the first time in the entire history of this church that there was a complete no-show for a church service. And that 5 minutes after the allotted time that they were to gather there, the church exploded. This was a huge explosion. It blew out windows all around this little town. It knocked a radio station off the air. If anybody had been in this church, they would certainly have been killed. But nobody was harmed because nobody was there. This made huge headlines throughout the nation. It was even carried in Life magazine, which was big at the time. And actually, statisticians and probability experts really took notice of this, one of whom was Warren Weaver, who was one of the great probability mathematicians, one of the experts of the day. He came to this little town and talked to people and figured the odds against chance of being over a million against one, that you could explain 15 people not showing up on that particular night of the year. And so people, journalists and reporters also descended on the town and interviewed all 15 of these people, asking them why didn't they go to choir practice that night. And interestingly, not one of them had any conscious clue that the church was going to explode. They all had trivial and mundane reasons for staying away, ranging from, well, the car wouldn't start, or I was doing homework, or listening to the radio and lost track of time. But interestingly, nobody had any conscious awareness of what was actually going to happen. And for me, this is a very strong indicator that premonitions serve a survival instinct, which is quite obvious in this case, and also that they can operate at the unconscious level, where you don't have a clue about why you're avoiding something, and also they can be collective. I think that this is a good example of what Carl Jung would have called the collective unconscious, in which the unconscious of people can interpenetrate and they can have a common awareness, albeit unconscious, and it can operate to save their lives.
Mm-hmm. And so it's tempting to think that this is the one case of a collective premonition, but of course there are many, many cases. They're not always quite as dramatic as everybody failing to show up at the appointed time.
Right.
But I don't recall whether in your book you talk about the case of 9/11 and people on the airplanes and in the buildings.
Indeed, I do.
Okay.
Actually, I was fascinated to discover the profound level of vacancy on all four of those doomed planes on September 11th. Before I bumped into this research, Dean, I think, like most Americans, figured that there were four jam-packed airplanes that went down on 9/11, and this simply wasn't the case. On average, those planes were 79% vacant, only about 21% full. This did not hold for just one or two of those planes, but this applied to all of them. I think the range, as I recall, of vacancy was 65 to 74%, something like that.
Wow.
And I happen to have had the opportunity to talk to people who canceled or rearranged their flights before a plane crashed. And I have yet to find anybody who did that, who changed their reservation and delayed their flight because they saw the airplane crashing. They seem to have a sense of ill ease, that today is just not a good day to fly, or something is just not right. That certainly seemed to be prevalent on 9/11, in which a lot of those people found some reason not to fly. So I don't want to make too much out of that because, you know, we don't have the vacancy rates of those specific flights months or weeks prior to that, but I can't believe that those flights, all four, were regularly 79% empty. So for me, this is indirect evidence that a collective kind of awareness may penetrate great numbers of people to warn them away from potentially lethal events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do a similar analysis in my book, Entangled Minds, where we have been collecting data online for many years on a simple precognition test. And what we saw was a very strong deficit of precognitive performance about starting about 2 weeks before 9/11 and continuing right up until that day. And the way I interpret that is that these simple precognition tests are basically you choose one out of four or five pictures, and if you're correct, you get a hit, otherwise you get a miss. So about 2 weeks before 9/11, people began to miss much more significantly than you would expect by chance. And the only way I can interpret that is that something was telling them not to perform as well, not to be as psychically perceptive at the moment, because something in your future is dangerous or should be repressed in some way. And so the only way that we can think of this is as a psychological form of repression, that we do get things at a deep unconscious level, and whether we act on it or not is yet another matter.
So people would not willingly engage that at a conscious level, this intuition or intimation that something terrible is going to happen. They would shy away from it. Is that the basic idea?
Yeah. Nobody likes to walk around with images of disasters in their head, even at an unconscious level. So consciously then you begin to repress it.
Yeah.
And so you repress also your ability to be able to give the right answer, so to speak, in an experiment. And so I wonder, I'm not too surprised then that in cases of life and death, like the chandelier falling and the church blowing up and so on, people don't consciously get it, but they don't feel right in some way, as you said.
You know, there is one excellent study looking not at crashed airplanes, but train wrecks, which was done by a guy named William Cox back in the 1950s when riding trains was a lot more popular than it is today. And he got the impression of reading about these train wrecks that there just seemed to be fewer people on the day of the train wreck than at other times. And so he did a study in which he compared the ridership on the day of dozens of wrecked trains and compared that with the vacancy rates 7, 14, 21, and 28 days prior. And he found out that in almost every case, there was statistically fewer riders on the train on the day of the train wreck. This is, I think, a very good study because he did have data of ridership and vacancies before, a month before the train actually crashed, unlike on 9/11. So, you know, whether it's crashed airplanes or wrecked trains, it does seem that people find some unconscious reason not to travel on the day of the disaster.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a pity that it's difficult or impossible to get data from the airlines, from the trains, and so on to check this, because the data is certainly there. We know that the airlines have data before, during, and after various crashes. But I guess it's always considered proprietary, and so we're not able to do these analyses.
You know, I talked to Rupert Sheldrake, whom IONS has funded in some of his research projects over the years. Rupert was fascinated as well by these high vacancy rates on 9/11 on those four airplanes, and actually contacted a person high up in the hierarchy at the American Airlines and was really discouraged. He was told that the CIA had impounded all of that data and that the airlines simply were not able, even if they'd wanted to provide that sort of information to Rupert. So he just sort of gave up on it.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that besides not being able to do some serious research on this issue, it fuels the conspiracy theories. You know, like, why? What difference would it make? Whether it's psychic or not psychic or whatever, that you would think that there would be anything to hide on this. So I don't quite get that.
Well, there are some tragic stories which I came across of people not involving the airplanes on 9/11. One of these stories was written up in the New York Times. I talk about it in the book, and it had to do with a man who was head of security on the bottom floor of one of the Twin Towers. And days before the disaster, he began to have a dream where the towers were falling, people were jumping out of the top stories. The world was just in chaos. Unknown to him, his wife began to have the same dream. And one morning at breakfast, she told him about her dream, and then he told her about his. They had not been cueing each other at all. So here you have husband and wife dreaming of, you know, disaster at the Twin Towers. And they were very analytical and rational people and decided that, you know, it's just a dream. And they both ignored it. And tragically, he died on 9/11 at work on the floor, bottom floor of one of the towers. So this was interesting to me because it presents one of the criteria, I think, for taking precognitive dreams seriously, and that's whether or not they're shared. This is just a really helpful criteria, you know, if you want to decide which dreams may have real value in terms of predicting future events and which ones just disregard. If they are shared, I think this is a huge clue that they probably should be taken seriously.
Yeah, I agree, because it's easy to let anxiety get in the way and paralyze you, so you never want to leave the house. So any kind of additional clue is useful to know whether to pay attention to it or not.
And while we're talking about that, I might just throw in a couple more criteria. One is if the dreams are recurrent, if they just occur night after night and as if they're clamoring for attention. That's a good clue to take the dream seriously. And also, if they deal with death, Carl Jung said that if you do have a dream of death, consider it carefully because you might not have a second chance.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's frightening. How about another criterion that's less frightening?
Yeah. Another criteria that's much less frightening is the vividness of the dream.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to scores of people about how they decide about whether or not they should take a dream seriously. And many of them arrive at this issue of vividness. One woman said that it seemed to her as if her dreams that turn out to come true are lit up from the inside. Mm-hmm. Another woman said that the dreams that she has that come true come to her in italics. I think all these are saying the same thing. The dreams are extremely vivid. They're numinous. They just seem to have a quality about them that sets them apart from ordinary dreams, which have no predictive value at all.
Mm-hmm.
And most people who keep dream diaries and really focus on and analyze their dreams seem to develop a sense, an inner sense of which dreams to take seriously with time. So I think that those criteria, whether or not they're shared, whether or not they dream of, they deal with death, or whether or not they're recurrent, and also whether or not they're vivid, can hold people in good stead who try to make sense of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that all sounds reasonable, and it probably holds for not just for premonition dreams, but dreams that have meaning about something. It could be telepathy, clairvoyance. It could be even something deeper than that, something about your psyche that's trying to tell you something. Like, I'm sure there must be instances of people having serious illnesses where the dream kept trying to tell them, go see the doctor.
Oh, exactly. There's one, my wife is a nurse, and she came across this one in her nursing literature. There was a woman who dreamt that a nurse appeared to her every night holding a light to her lower leg as if to show her something. And this dream came back every night for about a year. And this poor woman didn't have a clue about what the message was. She couldn't crack the symbolism at all. She did, however, make the connection that the nurse in the dream with the lamp was sort of the iconic image of Florence Nightingale, the famous nurse who founded secular modern nursing. And at the end of a year, this woman erupted in a severe case of bone infection, osteomyelitis, at the point where that nurse, for every night for a year, had been shining the light. But this is an extremely interesting dream to me, because the precognitive interval there was about a year, and it was profoundly symbolic. It's hard to know what to do with those kinds of dreams, because if you can't crack the symbolism, what do you do? I think the lesson may be that you just be with it and be patient, and maybe, just maybe, sooner or later, the dream meaning will declare itself to you.
The dream as described doesn't sound very symbolic. I don't know that much about dream analysis, but I would imagine that a recurring dream of that type, where it doesn't sound like it's very obscure. I'm not sure that I would necessarily. And in fact, even if she had the first night gone to a doctor and said, "What's wrong with my leg?" they might not have found anything.
Oh, I'm sure they would not have, because, yeah, I don't think you can have incipient osteomyelitis, a bone infection, for a solid year without it erupting and causing symptoms.
So that makes you wonder: is it the body that knows something is up and letting the unconscious mind know, or is it the woman's awareness that is somehow reaching far into her future and feeling the pressure of this future event?
Or could it be that this is a psychosomatic event in which she may have caused a symptom at that particular point by dwelling on it? I don't know how you decide between all of those possibilities.
Well, and another possibility is that the dream nurse is actually a real entity of some sort and holding up a radiation lamp and causing the cancer in the first place.
Oh, my.
So, no, it's true. We get
I'm
into fantasy and science fiction in thinking about it, but at this point, you're right. We don't really know how to discriminate among such explanations.
Well, my choice would be to make lemonade out of lemons here and say that this was a benevolent, charitable nurse who was just trying to give her a compassionate warning, and I'm prepared to be wrong on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might have been a demon wearing a Florence Nightingale mask, but that's true. I tend to think more positively about these things.
Yes, let's do.
So your book on premonitions came out last October, I guess. It was published
actually
last?
Actually, came out last May, so it's been out almost a year, and I'm happy to say that the paperback is coming out May 1st.
Oh, excellent. So that's a good sign. That means that the publishers are pleased and keeping it in print.
Yep, they are. And, they're pleased. I'm happy.
And rather than spending the $20, maybe in paperback it's $10?
It'll be about 10 bucks. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I see. Also, it's available on Kindle and probably other e-books as well.
Yes, it's on MP3 format and Kindle and also a 6. I know it's an 8 CD set if anybody does CDs anymore.
Do you know who reads the book? Who's the reader for the audiobook?
I should know, but I'm blocking on the gentleman's name now.
Is it the same reader that you have for other books too?
No,
I see the name, Jim Bond.
Jim Bond, that's exactly right. Thank you, Dean. Yeah.
Does he have a good resonant voice like yours with a slight Texan twang?
Fortunately, he has no Texas accent at all. No. He's an excellent reader and does what I consider to be an admirable job. I'm quite proud of that 8 CD set, by the way.
Hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen a CD in years. It's like it's so 1999. if it's not a downloadable MP3 by now, then I wouldn't even know what to do with it.
Yeah, this is an MP3 CD that's available in addition to the regular CDs.
Mm-hmm. Let's check with Jeffrey to see if it's a good time to take calls. Otherwise, we can keep going.
Sure. It's certainly a good time. Always a good time to take calls from our members. If you have a question for Larry Dossey, just press 1 on your phone, and I will bring the mic over to you. Okay, good. We have our first question from Lucia. Lucia, you have the mic.
Hi, Dr. Dossey. Hi, Dr. Riggs.
Hi.
Do you have any people who maybe haven't, rather than having a feeling about premonition, I'm just going to have to put this in the first person in order to keep from being inarticulate. I sometimes I see a blue flashes of light or indigo flashes of light before someone's going to pass away. It would be very handy if these lights were labeled so I knew kind of in what direction to look. But that it isn't always clear to me who is going to pass away, but within a couple of weeks of me starting to see these kinds of flashes of light, someone does. That's close enough to me a part of what's going on. So I wonder if anyone else has a different manifestation of premonition. I'm leaving out the dreams and the kinds of premonitions that happen that I have that are easier to identify. This recently confounded me, and I wondered if anyone else has this kind of odd vacation.
Well, we don't want to call them odd. I just think they're not the usual presentation of premonitions, but they're certainly not uncommon. In the book, I talk about a friend of mine, a fellow physician that I met in the course of researching this book, who was an OBGYN doctor in Oklahoma City at one of the major hospitals there, a doctor named Larry Kinchelow. His premonitions took the form of a sensation in the body that was actually painful. And so the lesson here for me is that premonitions have a huge spectrum of manifestation to people. They're not always dreams. They can be waking visions. They can just be something on the order of a hunch or a gut feeling. But they can also involve physical sensations such as what you experience. And in Dr. Kinchelow's experience, it happened to be chest pain. Before one of his patients would deliver, he would invariably begin to experience pain in his chest as a warning sign that a patient was going to deliver. This became so reliable that the nurses at the hospital actually picked up on it. And they would actually phone him and ask him how his chest was feeling. when they had one of his patients in the hospital whom they were uncertain when to expect the baby to come. So there's a huge variation in how these things present.
How long was it before he figured out that this was premonitions and stopped having his heart checked?
Well, it was very early on in his practice. He had finished his training and had been practicing about 3 years. He was in his 30s when this happened. And the first time it happened, he didn't know how to interpret this. But he had a patient in the hospital. It was their first baby. And the nurses and he both believed that it would be hours and hours and hours before she delivered. So it was a weekend. He goes home and he starts raking leaves. And all of a sudden, he has this horrible chest pain associated with this extraordinary urge to dash back to the hospital. This made no sense whatsoever to this man. But the chest pain would not go away. He found himself obsessed with the desire to rush back to the hospital, which he did. And when he walked onto the floor, the nurses said, "What on earth are you doing here? We just checked her, and she's nowhere near delivery." And he said, "To tell you the truth, I haven't the slightest idea why I'm here." And at that moment, there was a scream down the hall and from his patient's room, and they grab a delivery tray and go to the room just in time to deliver this woman's baby in bed. After that, the chest pain and the deliveries were invariable. He doesn't know how to explain it. Nobody else does. But it's so invariable that this, I think, is just simply a very unusual way of knowing that involves precognition associated with a physical symptom.
Story's making me think of the HeartMath Institute and their work on the sentience of the heart.
Yeah, it's possible. This is Dean. That the curious thing about this particular way of presenting is that it doesn't sound. It's not pleasant for one thing. You know, it's like getting hit on the head with a board. You would think that it would be. It'd be more useful from a survival point of view to get something like flashing lights, blue lights appear suddenly. That's a much less invasive way of getting a signal than feeling like you're having a heart attack.
Yeah. Yeah, if I had my choice, I would take your blue lights.
Yeah. So the way I see it is that's a pretty good gift. That's good.
Thank you both.
Thank you for calling.
Okay. Take our next question from Linda. Linda, you have the mic.
Hello, Dr. Dossie.
Hi, Linda.
I was wondering, this is sort of half comment, half question. I've had both personally and in a lot of reading I've done, there's a lot of communication from people who are no longer in their bodies, who have so-called died. And I wonder how many of the premonitions people get could be some form of communication from those in the spirit world.
Well, I think probably quite a few. There are some cases in the book where I talk about this kind of communication, and I have the idea that consciousness is what we call non-local, which is to say that it's omnipresent, it's present everywhere, and it's infinite, not just in space, but in time as well. And if you go to that sort of image of consciousness, you open the door for the reception of information from people who have made their transition. And I don't find it's surprising at all, and certainly you know as well as we do that these are extraordinarily common experiences.
I mean,
so,
I could talk, you know, talking about non-local experience, I sometimes, especially if I've been with someone, spent some time together, I can feel the person thinking about me and having certain feelings about me, you know, like 5 hours after we've separated, it seems like spending time together makes that connection more acute for me. But I've also felt people, you know, who I hadn't seen in days or long periods of time, I would just feel a sense of their presence, and then I would feel the state they were in, and they could be having a strong positive or negative feeling about me, and I would know what it was.
You know, there's one study I talk about in the book of highly educated nurses with master's degrees or PhDs, and the research question was, have you had any experiences from patients or loved ones who have departed? And almost half of these high-powered nurses answered in the affirmative. Now, these are not flaky people. These are people who are ultimately practical and spend their lives in life and death situations. And I just want to say that if this level of education is associated with these kinds of experiences, that this must be tremendously common in people who are just keeping their mouths shut.
Well, that was my thought. It's so unfortunate that they can't just come out and talk about it openly without risking their reputations.
Well, there is a stigma associated with it, and particularly people who are in academic situations, as Dean and I have talked about before, there really is a price to be paid for going public with some of these experiences, unfortunately. And we're, you know, dancing as fast as we can to talk about these things as normal consciousness functioning, so that hopefully one day the stigma will not be there.
Well, I certainly hope so. There are a few people in my personal life who think I'm totally flaky because I made the mistake of speaking to them about some of my experiences.
You know, it does raise the question of it's like the sighted person in the land of the blind. For the blind or people who don't have these kinds of experiences, this does sound kind of nutty. It doesn't matter that there's experimental evidence and lots of anecdotal evidence saying that it doesn't matter if it's nutty, it's true. And so I don't know whether in the future, for example, if the science gets to a point where we have proof positive of these kinds of phenomena, I think that even under those cases, there will be people who simply refuse to accept it because it's not part of their reality.
That would be my guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at someone like Ian Stevenson, who said he wasn't bothered so much by the fact that people didn't believe his research, but he was more bothered by the fact that they said that without even looking at it.
Right. Yeah, well, I guess people will always see what they want to see.
Right. Believing is seeing, right? Or
yeah.
Not seeing, as the case may be.
Right.
I know. That it just seems like there's such a big divide between people who, well, people don't seem to want to see it because it's threatening to their sense of reality, and that way of looking at things is very foreign to me, but I understand how many people are like that. I've always been very curious and sort of an explorer, whether it's inner or outer. So I think it's fascinating, and other people are threatened.
Mm-hmm. And as I was saying before, there's a certain comfort in having a conservative society that provides a stable base, so that people like yourself and the kind of work that Larry and I do, we're given essentially a luxury to be able to spend time looking at the outer limits, because we don't have to grow our own food and drive a truck to, you know, and all of the other things that are necessary in order to give us this luxury.
I thought that was a very insightful comment.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both.
Thanks, Linda.
Okay. I don't have a name for this question, but you just pressed one, so you know who you are.
Hi, Jeffrey. It's Charlene.
Okay.
I wanted to mention about a constellation of short dreams. A couple months ago, my daughter Sarah had a nightmare that our new puppy, Finn, had fallen off a cliff, and she was really upset about this dream. And several days later, and coincidentally, right before this happened, I had Finn in the car with Angela and I, and when I opened the door for her to get out, he almost jumped out on a busy street. But he was fine, and I just said, okay, well, we need to pay closer attention to him. And probably about a week later, my daughter Laura's boyfriend's brother died in a tragic fall. And he was someone who was very puppy-like. And we don't really know what happened to him. But in any case, the dream about Sarah and Finn came to mind. Also, that morning after Sean died, both of his grandparents had a dream that they were cleaning out his apartment and he wasn't there. And also, a few days after that, I had a dream that that I was with his mom and stepdad, and I was telling them, you know, Sean's not really dead. You know, people are ready to have this funeral, but he's not dead. He's really still with us, and it was very vivid and very real. So all of these dreams happen around the death of this vibrant young man, and I guess it brings up a lot of issues about both communication from the other side as well as precognition, and I just wanted to share it because the dream particularly that I had was quite comforting, and it was a dream that after I woke up from it, it took me a while to realize that that wasn't the that wasn't waking reality. It was one of those dreams that just had a real vivid feel to it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And who's to say what real reality is?
Right, yeah. Interestingly, the last conversation I had with Sean, which was a couple weeks before, I was talking with him and the kids about Jung's idea that what you don't make conscious comes to you as fate. And he was very intrigued by that conversation and very engaged with it. Young man going to be a teacher in his fifth year of teacher training.
You know, there are some dreams that are so complex that it just defies anybody's ability to, interpret them. And I think that when we're faced with situations like that we would do best just simply to back off and be respectful and be patient and ask that the dream present itself in an explanatory way to us in its own good time. I just think that sometimes we have to live with the mystery, although we are generally impatient and we want to know the meaning on the spot. It just doesn't always work like that.
Well, I think that speaks to a lot of James Hillman's work about, you know, and Stephen Eisenstadt, people who work with being with the dream presence rather than trying to reduce it to an explanation. And yeah. I didn't mean to say by that last conversation that I was interpreting the meaning of Sean's death.
I understand. Sure.
You know. Yeah, yep. That was just what happened.
Yep, got it.
Thank you,
Jeffrey. And we've got one last question from Shyama, bringing the mic over to you.
Okay, well, you know, this is a question about premonitions and from another context, which was, as you remember, some years back, a book called Psychic Discoveries in the USSR, which they interviewed, among other people, some psychics. When they had clients come to them and they could actually see an event in the future that was not so great, actually be a death. They were tremendously conflicted. I just wondered, in your research, did you find anybody who had such clear visions of something, and how did they handle that?
Well, I mentioned one example already of the security official on the bottom floor of one of the Twin Towers who had a dream of many deaths with the falling towers, and his way of handling it was denial. You know, certainly I don't think any of us would recommend that. So just to say that, you know, there are a spectrum of responses that one could take. I mentioned also at the beginning of the program, Amanda, the young mother, her way of handling her premonition that her baby was going to be killed was to intervene and take the baby out of the dangerous situation. Those are two ends of the spectrum, and I suspect that most people are somewhere in between.
I just saw that Lucia has a follow-up question. I'm also noting that we've reached the top of the hour, so I want to respect your time, Dr. Dossi. Are you okay taking a follow-up question, or
okay.
Do you need to go?
Sure,
okay.
Yeah.
Lucia, bringing the mic back over to you.
Thanks. It's kind of a comment that follows up on the last lady's question. My mother died when I was very young, and she I don't think she had found out she was sick yet. When there was a, there used to be sometimes gypsies that would move through the that area of Illinois where I grew up. And there was a sort of an encampment about 50 miles away, and the word gets around, you know, oh, there's fortune tellers over there. They'll tell your fortune. Let's go. And my mom went with a couple of her friends to go have her fortune told. And everyone would have to go in by themselves. You didn't go in a group. You had your time with the person who was doing the fortune, and someone else, you know, you get yours done, and then someone else would come in. And when my mother came in, they took her hand and they told her some things. I won't go into any detail, but they wouldn't take her money. And my mom got home and she told my dad, well, they wouldn't take any money from me, and they told me I was going to be as beautiful in that I was being as beautiful in death as I am in life. And she was she passed away within 2 years.
Hmm.
And I heard this story when I was growing up, and I come to find out later, because my family, the other people in the family didn't know this, but there's a tradition that you don't take money from someone that you see is going to die. But that's you just never do that if you are gifted with that and you're in that culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought of that when the last lady was speaking, and that's how they resolve it ethically when they see a future that isn't as happy.
Well, I want to simply say that I'm skeptical. I'm tremendously open to the fact that some people can see the future and are fortune tellers who really do pack the gear and are psychic in sometimes extraordinarily accurate ways. But I want to part from the idea that those kinds of predictions are written in stone. I don't think that the future is fixed. And I believe that there's always the possibility of what's been called choice acting on chance. So I'm uncomfortable with the idea that we should take anybody's prediction absolutely, literally, as if it's fixed and can't be changed. Now, that's an idea that is not acceptable to a lot of people who place vast confidence in horoscopes and psychics and so on. But that's simply my personal notion toward it. And I think that we can become pathologically fixed in our reliance upon other people's premonitions about our own future. I do have a couple of friends who won't even begin their day without looking at their horoscope in the newspaper, and who will not make any major decision without consulting someone else's opinion about their future. So I think that balance and discrimination are necessary, and that we can go to extremes in either direction, relying too completely upon someone else's sense of what our future is going to be, or completely ignoring it. I think, as with most things regarding the psyche, balance is the key.
Right, and I would add to that that on some kinds of predictions, we know with 100% certainty that they will work, and it doesn't require a psychic, and that prediction is that someone's going to die. I mean,
well, I wouldn't
so far.
Believe in anyone with the impression that they said that. My dad said she was kind of curious that they hadn't really given her any kind of fortune telling when they had done with her friends, her two friends that went with her.
I see.
But they didn't say anything like that, but they wouldn't take her money.
Yeah.
And the other lady who had spoken, but right before I asked, what had said, you know, how do you handle this ethically when you see something really bad, and you know, what do you do? What do you say? And I'm on your side. I really think that nothing is set in stone.
Uh-huh.
And as far as I know, and I'm pretty clear, this was lore of the family. They didn't give her a fortune.
Yeah.
They
I
didn't
see.
Say it. And I think that anyone who does say that kind of thing, gifted or not, is probably up to no good, and certainly doesn't know anything about what we're talking about tonight, which is the difference between power trips and probability. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Dr. Aiden. I should be quiet now. See?
No, what you said is well said. I agree.
Yeah, I agree too. And I just want to add that there's a lot of wisdom to what you just said about power trips and predicting futures as if you know. You know, we physicians often do that sometimes unthinkingly in terms of making prognoses for people. And as every physician knows, people do have the ability to die on time. And this is one of the real ethical issues about making prognoses when someone's sick. Simply declaring that somebody's got 6 months to live can set them up for dying in six months. So it's a tricky issue, and so there you are.
Yep.
Great. Thank you, Lucia. And thank you, everyone, for your questions. And
yeah.
Dean, I will turn it back over to you.
Well, I want to thank Larry very much for stimulating conversation, as always.
Well, as always, it's fun, Dean. Thank you.
Good. And I have a premonition that we're probably going to do this again.
You know what? I have the same premonition.
Excellent. Well, let's see. A book comes out in hardback and then paperback, so I don't know what the next form of it will be, but it'll be something, and we'll talk about it again, I'm sure.
Let's do. Thanks, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this program from IONS. Located in Petaluma, California, the Institute of Noetic Sciences is a nonprofit membership organization that conducts scientific research into the potentials and powers of consciousness. To learn more about IONS, please visit us at www.noetic.org or call toll-free 877-769-4667.